book of Proverbs would be in chapter 22. Proverbs chapter 22. We'll look at 22 and 23 this evening. Proverbs 22 and verse 2. Solomon records the rich and poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of all. You know, the Bible throughout indicates that it doesn't matter rich or poor, famous or unknown. Despite what Solomon said about that, we're going to be together. We know that in this world, the rich rule over the poor. Has been referred to as the golden rule. Those with the gold make rule. And that's the way it is many times. The people who have wealth and are able to use that as leverage to be able to get themselves into positions of power. And Solomon understood that. Solomon probably understood that if he had been born to someone that was not the king, he probably would have been the king. God saw him for his heart as he chose him to rule over his people. But we need to understand that in most cases, the rich rule over the poor. That doesn't mean the richest person is always going to get to be president. Not always. Sometimes that doesn't work that way. In fact, most of the time, the richest person doesn't run for president because he can make a lot more money doing whatever he's already doing. But sometimes, it just means that those who have the wealth, and they have that ability then to use that. And they're going to have some influence as a result of that. And they rule then over the poor. And notice then what he says. And the borrower is servant or slave. Like we're serving those folks. Because it seems like half of our paycheck goes to those folks that we owe money to. And the other half of it goes to the bills that we made that month. And then we don't have anything left for us. I better not forget that about a third of it goes to the government, too, out of those checks. You know, so they always, you know, but when we owe somebody money. Now, of course, at this time, when Solomon was writing this, if you owed somebody money and you didn't pay it back, why, they could throw you in prison or they could just take all of whatever you had and take you as a servant to them. Literally as a slave. And now we don't allow that in our country anymore. But we still have that. We owe that money. We're indebted to those people. We're in servitude to them to some degree because of that. And all the more reason then to get rid of those debts, to get to the point where we are not borrowing money from other people, especially from people who aren't Christians. Because they will put restraints upon us that we don't want to keep, that we don't want to be bound with. In verse 13, he says, the slothful man saith, there is a lion without. I shall be slain in the streets. And I guess this is a perfect example of one excuse is as good as another. The man's so lazy, he doesn't want to go out to work, or he doesn't want to go out to whatever, to do whatever he's supposed to do. So he goes, well, there's a lion out there, and the lion might eat me if I go out outside. So I'm going to stay in the house. Well, one excuse is as good as another. He wants to make excuses, he still finds something to make an excuse for. Now, it doesn't matter that the lion doesn't live in this country. That it's in another day. He's still, well, there's a lion out there somewhere, and it's going to get me. Or it might be, well, you know, there's a thunderstorm coming. I might get hit by lightning. Or, you know, there's snakes out there, and one of them might bite me. Or, you know, you can go on and on with the excuses that people will make not to do the things that they're supposed to do. The dog ate my homework. You know, it was a famous one when I was a kid. You know, to keep, or you know, any kind of thing like that. You know, that. Just to get out of the responsibility. And people haven't changed much in 3,000 years, have they? They still aren't. Now, I haven't heard anybody recently say, well, there's a lion out there. I'm going to get eaten if I go out in the street. But they make some excuses that are about as outlandish, that are just about as far out as that. And all kinds of things that people will say not to have to do what they should do. Verse 28 is a very compelling verse. He says, remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. When I read this verse, I think about the church. And I think about how we might, you know, sometimes they're called the church fathers, but when we think about the apostles who helped Christ build his church in the first century, and the foundation that they laid, and the doctrine that they laid, and then I think today about how many people are going about removing those ancient landmarks. All of the things that Jesus put into his church, that the apostles put as parts of the church, as doctrines of the church, and how people today just disregard those things. They just throw them aside. Cast this one over that way, and cast this one over that way, and always with some excuse, well, times have changed, or, well, that was just a cultural thing, or any number of excuses. But what they're really doing is they're removing the ancient landmarks that our fathers, spiritual fathers, if you will, the apostles set. And whether it be in the physical sense of removing landmarks, or whether it be in the spiritual sense, Solomon says, don't remove those landmarks. There are many people who will have to give account to God for the landmarks that they've moved. Things that were there to mark the path to heaven, mark the path of right, and yet somebody didn't see fit to keep it that way. They thought they knew better than Jesus did, or better than the apostles who were led by the Holy Spirit, and they think they know better than them how to build the church, and so they build it according to their own blueprint instead of the Bible. We've got to watch out for that. Then in chapter 23, verses 4 and 5 go together. Really a whole section there, all the way out down to about 8, all kind of goes together. It's talking about when you're with someone wealthy or someone of great esteem, a ruler or something of that nature. I know we all the time are out to dinner with governors and presidents and congressmen and things of that nature were so important. So, but he does give some advice to those situations. But then in verses 4 and 5, he says, labor not to be rich. Cease from thine own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. And that's the way it is for those who have set their eyes on riches. It doesn't matter how wealthy they become, there are still more riches out there that they haven't got. And they keep setting their eyes on that, they keep chasing after it, and they never seem to attain what they're looking for. They can have enough money to buy anything that they could possibly want, but that's not enough money for them. They still want more. It's never satisfied. That desire, that greed, can never be satisfied. Even if somebody ruled the whole world and owned the whole thing, it wouldn't be enough for them. They'd want the moon then. They'd want Mars. There's always something else that they want that they can't have. And so they strive after that. Solomon says, don't put yourself through that misery. He doesn't say it's a sin to have wealth, or that it's wrong to have money, or that it's wrong to work, to be able to make money, to have money. But he says, don't let that be your goal. Don't let that be what you set your heart on. He says, those riches make wings, and they fly away. And how many people in our own country's history, probably as a whole, the wealthiest nation ever to exist on this earth, and how many of the wealthiest people of our nation, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, all of those fabulously wealthy people of the past, wound up dying bankrupt? What happened to all of their funds? Think about Donald Trump. I think he's gone bankrupt about 2 or 3 times. Billionaire bankrupt. Billionaire bankrupt. That's the way money works. It's just, it flies away. You never seem to have enough. And even what you get, you can't hold on to. You put it into the stock market and the stocks go down. You put it into the bank and the bank gets robbed. You know, I mean, you hide it under your mattress and somebody comes in and steals it from you. It seems like something always happens to it. Money doesn't remain. And what we know even more certain than that is what Jesus said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where rust does not corrupt and moths don't break in and don't eat it up, and where thieves don't break in and steal. That's where your treasure needs to be. Because where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What are all these things? All of this money, it's made out of physical material that's going to burn up on the last day. So why are we so wrapped up in it? Why do we have to have it so badly? Somebody said, well, we need money to live. Well, we do. We do have to buy food, and we have to buy clothing and shelter. But when we set our hearts on those things, we're going to live a miserable existence. We're going to become like old Scrooge from the old Dickens story of A Christmas Carol, where it's all selfishness, wanting more and more and more for me. We need to watch out for that kind of an attitude. And then verses 13 and 14. It is amazing how some of these things are just set right next to one another in these passages. Verse 13, he says, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod, and it shall deliver his soul from hell. Now some folks have taken this verse as an excuse to abuse children. They said, well, see, he says you beat him with the rod, so we, you know, we just beat him with it. Well, perhaps the translation is not quite written in such a way that will help us to understand it the best. Another translation says, punish them with the rod. Punish him with the rod. Not just beat him. You don't just whack him upside the head. Because you actually can kill somebody if you beat him with a rod enough. So he's talking about restrained discipline. He's talking about doing it in such a way to discipline, to punish them for wrongdoing so they won't continue that wrongdoing. What good would it do you if you beat them to death? Well, that wouldn't come. And many times, people get out of control with the children. They out of anger and frustration, they begin to hit, to beat, and hurt the child. But the idea that Solomon gets across to us is, if you use this rod of correction in the right way, and notice that withhold not correction. It is to correct behavior. It's going to stop them from doing that behavior. If it's unpleasant to them, they will stop. But he says, the goal is not just to take out your anger or your frustration. The goal is not to make you feel better about it. The goal is to deliver the child's soul from hell. Now, when you think about that before you discipline the child, you're not going to do it in such an angry way that you lose control of yourself, because your first and foremost thought is going to be for that child. If you're concerned for that child's soul, you're going to do what is necessary to keep them in the right path. Then verse 23. We were talking about money a little while ago up in verses 4 and 5. Well, here's something that you can buy that's truly worthwhile. Solomon says, buy the truth. Now, you can't buy that with dollars and cents, unless you can go out and buy a Bible. But you can't buy the truth in that way with cash or check or credit card. You buy the truth by understanding and learning. He says, not only buy it, but sell it not. You know, some people had the truth and they sold it. They traded it away for something else. Fame, fortune, popularity, family, friends. They traded it away. They had the truth, but they didn't keep it. They sold it. And what a sad thing that was. But then he says also, in addition to the truth, wisdom and instruction and understanding. These are things that it doesn't matter how poor we may become, we can still own truth, understanding, instruction, wisdom. We can own most things, even if we don't own a single other thing in this world. Those are the kinds of things Solomon informs us are worthwhile. As we close this evening, we've got a long section at the end of chapter 23, from verses 29 through 35. It always amazes me in our culture that they go further and further. I'm not a fan of smoking or of tobacco or chewing tobacco or any of the kinds of uses of tobacco, snuff or any of it. And I don't think it's a good thing for a Christian to be involved in. But it is amazing in our society how they continue to make restrictions on the use of tobacco. Restaurants and even bars, you can't smoke there, and on and on, you can't smoke in stores. And they continue to make these restrictions on tobacco. But at the same time, there's another drug out there that's far more destructive, and that's alcohol. And yet they want it to be freely used. They encourage even the use of it in many cases. They just always say, well, drink responsibly. Don't drink and drive. And yet, despite the admonition not to drink and drive, thousands are killed every year in this country's highways as a result of people who are drinking and driving. And it amazes me to no end that they continue to make these restrictions I don't like smoking, but at the same time, I never heard about somebody who smoked up 2 packs of cigarettes and they were so high off of it that they went out and wrecked into somebody and killed a whole family of 5 or something like that. You know, you don't hear about those things, but how many times have you heard about somebody who drank up a 12-pack or a whole fifth of whiskey or something, and then they go out and kill somebody because they're drunk and driving? Our country, we've gotten so far from some of the things that the Bible teaches, it's frightening. But so many of our lawmakers enjoy that alcohol so much. That's why they won't make any laws against it. But we look to verse 29 and following, and let's look at some of the things that Solomon said about it. He says, who has woe? That means, who's just moaning and groaning? Who has sorrow? Who has contention? That's strife. Who has babbling? Well, you ever heard somebody drunk talk? I'm going to talk about babbling. Who has wounds without cause? You know, who's bruised and battered from tripping and falling downstairs or from running into light posts or any number of other things that they've done to themselves because they were so drunk they couldn't walk? Who has redness of the eye? And then he answers the question. They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine, the mixed wines were stronger than the regular wine. Then he says in verse 31, look not. Now, you know, it's amazing how many Christian folks will read this verse and then go all around the world to try to say, well, that doesn't mean I can't drink. Follow this verse for just a minute. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. Now he says, don't even look at the wine. Now where in there is there permission to drink it? Don't look at, well, I'll close my eyes and drink it then. It'll be okay. We've got to understand what Solomon's saying here. He says this alcohol is such a dangerous thing that you don't even need to be looking in that direction, much less drinking it. You know, it's kind of like Jesus said the same. He said, whosoever looks at a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in his heart. And we say, well, it's okay, then we'll just keep our eyes closed and go ahead and have that relationship and it won't matter then because we didn't look at her. We know good and well what Solomon means, but I've even heard preachers go out of their way to say, well, you know, the Bible nowhere says we can't drink. Solomon says, not only don't drink, don't even look at it. Stay away from it. Notice what he said. You know,
the way he talks about it, it sounds like maybe he'd had some experience with it, or at least had known some people who did. Notice what he says. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Those are poisonous snakes that can kill you. And he says alcohol is the same way. It'll bite you and it'll sting you and it'll poison you. He says in verse 33, thine eyes shall behold strange women, and thine heart shall utter perverse things. I don't know how many times when I was young, I talked to other young people who had gone to a party and had gotten drunk at that party and then had done some things that they regretted for the rest of their lives. Because they started by doing something they shouldn't have done in the first place. Things that they never would have done if they had been sober. But because of the alcohol and the drunkenness, they let down their guard. And they did all kinds of things that affected their life for the rest of their lives. They'll never get over some of those things. Then verse 34, he says, yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. Isn't that just the way people do when they get involved with alcohol? They wake up the next morning, they're sore, and they're sick, and they're vomiting it up, and they've got headaches, they've got a hangover, and they say, well, I'm going to go sleep it off for a little while, and then when they get up and they're still feeling bad, they say, well, I want a little bit more of the hair of that dog that bit me. They turn right back to it. Now, we know that that's not good sense. And yet, Hollywood has made it a funny thing, the television. It's something to joke about and laugh about when somebody's stumbling, falling down drunk. That's supposed to be funny to us. But we need to understand there is nothing funny about the condition. It's not something humorous. It's not something to laugh about or to laugh at. These are folks that have serious problems and need serious help. What does he say? When shall I awake so I can seek it again? Go right back to it. It's very difficult. Once someone has become hooked on alcohol and has become an alcoholic, it is so, oh, oh, so hard ever to get them to stay away from it. Now, a lot of people say, well, I just drink a little bit. It's not going to affect me. I can handle it. And a lot of those very same folks in a few years are drunks. Alcoholics. Solomon warns us the way to stay away from becoming an alcoholic, there's only one way. If you never drink it, you'll never be addicted. It's amazing. I can't remember the last time, as a matter of fact, I can't remember ever seeing a television show or a movie of folks who were going out to eat or going to do, where somebody, they weren't drinking alcohol. It's just such a commonly accepted practice in our society that nobody even thinks twice about it. And the idea to them that somebody doesn't drink alcohol is, they can't imagine. And that's a sad thing that our society is that far backwards from what God wants. I recall a story of one of the families from the church where my dad preaches, and they had gone to Mexico, I think some of them had actually gone to Spain. They were in Europe on a trip, and they, every time at every restaurant they'd go to, they'd offer them wine with their meal. And the lady would tell them, no vino, no wine. And she just could not get across to this particular waiter that she just really didn't want wine. He said, "Oh well, you had some bad wine somewhere, but this is good wine. This is not like what you know." He just couldn't understand that somebody would just not want to drink. Boggled his mind. But I'm quite the opposite. It boggles my mind that anybody does want to drink that stuff. First of all, it's rotten. I mean, literally, that's what fermenting is. It is rotting. That's how they make the stuff. They have to rot it for a while first. Now, I don't know about you, but in my house, when food starts to get rotten, we throw it out or throw it to the dog. We don't eat it ourselves. And yet, this is supposed to be some sort of special delicacy of these different kinds of wines. It's rotten. Not only that, it's something that if I drink it, it's going to make me lose my ability to walk, to see straight. I'm going to lose my ability to make sound judgment. That's always one of the things about the Don't Drink and Drive campaign that always amazed me. They're asking drunk people to make sensible decisions about whether to drive or not. They always think they're okay to drive. "Oh, I'm fine. I can drive. No, I haven't had that much. Had 2 6-packs and a half a bottle of whiskey, but I haven't had that much. I'm okay." We've got to understand that God knows the human body, and it was never intended for alcohol. One of the first cases that we read of in the Bible of serious problems results from alcohol. We read about Noah after the flood. Here he is. He's come off of a cleansed land, and so what does he do? He plants a vineyard. And he makes himself some wine, and he drinks too much of it, and he gets drunk. And after that, his son comes in and sees his nakedness. And this, but if he'd have been sober, he wouldn't have been laying around naked for his son to see it. He would have had more decorum about himself. And then it's always interesting to me that he cursed his son for seeing him naked when he was the one that was drunk. But you don't want to be in a compromising situation. You don't want to be embarrassed, so you blame somebody else. So he put that curse on Canaan, the son of Canaan. And that's the other thing I don't get. Why on earth did he curse Canaan? Canaan wasn't the one. It was Ham that did it. Why do you want to curse somebody that wasn't even involved? And then we have Lot, the only righteous man in all of Sodom. And he goes out with his two daughters, and they get him up in the mountains. And they've been living in that sinful, wicked city so long that it's rubbed off on them. And they get him drunk so that they can lie with him, so that he can father their children. They get him drunk. But see, if he was not a drinker of alcohol, they never could have gotten him drunk without trickery and deceit, at least. It amazes me sometimes things that people who claim to be Christians will do, to go around passages that are just so clear. Alcohol is an evil. Well, the Lord made grapes. Yes, and grape juice is a wonderful thing. It's got all sorts of health benefits. Drink as much of it as you want. But wine and beer, well, those grains I'm sure could have some better use than to make thousands of people drunk every day. Feed them to the horses. Feed them to the cows. Feed them any other kinds of animals, but don't use them to make alcohol. Why do we do these things to ourselves when God has warned us what the end is going to be? It's going to bite like a serpent, sting like a snake. It's going to add. If you think about alcohol, and to the young people, you'll get 21, and you'll be old enough, supposedly, to drink. Don't even start. Don't even think about it. Don't even consider it. Get into high school, and the other kids in high school, even though they're not old enough, even though they're not of age to buy it legally, they'll get a hold of it. They'll be drinking it. There'll be parties. And then they invite you. Don't go. If you get yourself there in a situation like that, bad things happen. You stay away from it. Don't get close to it. If you're here tonight and you haven't need to respond to the invitation for any reason, we ask that you do so as it stands.